both the court cases kind of revolved around and resolved around both of them proving their sex, proving sex in the courtroom. So I'm really interested in my research in kind of these moments and in classifications, how classifications get made and remade. And at this time, through this example, I think we can see a really interesting slippage between medical and legal definitions of sex in Britain. And you can see attempts to police the boundary between the medical and the legal, but these kind of boundaries never hold. And of course, these aren't the only kind of slippery, leaky boundaries that you see going on in this history, because the distinctions and classifications between trans, intersex, homosexuality are kind of leaky and contested and being made and remade the whole time. So this is the first court case I'm going to talk about, April Ashley, in the case Corbett versus Corbett. The legal scholar Alex Sharp has argued that to think legal sex at all is always to think of, through, against, and or beyond this primal scene. And quite brilliantly, she says, there's no escape from the labyrinthine structure of Corbett. So who was she? This is just my excuse to show you some fabulous pictures of April. Born in 1935, and assigned male. In 1960, she had one of what was at the time referred to in the press as sex change surgeries, in big inverted commas. And that's her. More recently, I think it was when she got her OBE, one of the BEs. Looking fabulous again. She had a brief but very successful career as a fashion model. I think that one's from her Vogue photo shoot. And she met, so she was a fashion model briefly until she was outed by the British press, which was around 1961, I think. She'd met Arthur Corbett in 1960 and they got married in 1963. They had quite a brief, tempestuous relationship, and after it broke down, April Ashley brought a petition for maintenance, but to fight this, because he didn't want to pay any money, he sought to dissolve the marriage on the basis that she was not, nor had never been, a woman. So he was arguing that a marriage had never been a marriage in the first place. So the case was heard in 1969 with a February 1970 decision. And this is a divorce case, but fascinatingly, it had the most amazing array of kind of current medical expertise on show in the courtroom. The judge, Justice Ormerod, was a medical man. Arthur Corbett called the top three as his expert witnesses, Professors Dewhurst and Dent and Dr. John Randall. April Ashley called Dr. Armstrong, Ivor Mills and Professor Roth. So Dewhurst and Armstrong on this list were pretty much the kind of the intersex experts of the time, publishing on intersex quite widely, not really agreeing with each other about how you do definitions and classifications and procedures and protocols. But I think very interestingly for my little history, Armstrong had previously suggested that we don't have a definition in the law. The law doesn't know what a man or a woman is by definition in 1955. So it's very interesting that he turns up in this case. And against the UK history, 1954 was the year that the Wolfenden Committee was formed, which then published the Wolfenden Report in 1957, recommending the partial decriminalisation of homosexuality, which didn't actually happen until 1967. So that's sort of the backdrop that Armstrong is coming from when he appears here. And you might recognise the name John Randall, who was at Charing Cross, who was incredibly influential and saw thousands of trans people in his time there. The same year, 1969, this kind of key interesting year, was this. The first international symposium on gender identity in London. In the same year, Dewhurst was there, Randall was there from that list, along with people from the US such as John Money, Richard Green, things like that. So Ormerod tries to, in the case, Judge Ormerod, he tries to make this distinction between a medical criteria for establishing sex and a legal basis of how you determine sex in a court case. Even more specific than that, he tried to or he says he's trying to restrict it to the question of what is a woman for the purposes of marriage, and not a more general question, he says, about a legal definition of sex. He completely fails spectacularly in this, and the so-called Corbett test hangs around in law as precedence from this moment kind of on, and has kind of huge, massive knock-on effects. And this is what he suggested, even though some of the medical professionals suggested we should add hormonal influences, psychological factors. For Judge Ormerand, he basically says congruence between chromosomes, gonads, and genitals at the time of birth are the three determining factors of sex in law. And he says, if there's ambiguity, then genitals should predominate. He doesn't say why, but, you know, this is not an unfamiliar story, I'm sure. So we'll come back to April Ashley, but I'll move on to Georgina Somerset. I don't want to go on for too long. So Georgina was born in 1923, assigned male, had what she describes as a corrective procedure in 1957, obtained a revised birth certificate in 1960, and married her husband, pictured here, in 1962. Interestingly, I think she's possibly the first intersex person to speak on television. I think most definitely on the BBC, because she featured on the 1966 Horizon programme called Sex Change, which is fascinating, and you can go and watch it like I did on a VHS at the Wellcome Library, and there she is. And it's very interesting because it starts off with the narrator saying we need to be really careful and not conflate trans and intersex and homosexuality, and then proceeds to conflate trans and intersex and homosexuality throughout, which is great. But and here she is here, and she does in an interview later, and she gave, like, decades later, she said that she was very disappointed because they spoke to her for about an hour and she said lots of interesting things, and then she basically gets about 3 or 4 minutes airtime. So it's not that great, but there she is on TV anyway. So she was kind of well known. You know, she wasn't, you know, the Christine Jorgensen, but she, you know, when she got married, she was on the front cover of the daily newspapers, both in London and in Paris, where they had their honeymoon. She'd been on the BBC, so she was quite well known. And then in 1969, Clifford Allen, who was a psychotherapist who'd been working with Lennox Ross Broster, that's a difficult one to say, at Charing Cross, and continued in the 30s and the 40s, and continued a professional relationship with John Randall when he took over the Charing Cross clinic there, and it became the biggest gender identity clinic in the UK. He wrote in a piece called Sex Change, Facts and Folklore, in a magazine journal for GPs. He wrote this article in which he apparently claimed that she's homosexual, she's had breast implants, she's done all these surgical things to herself, so she's not a woman, and her marriage is not legal. Georgina Somerset was a dentist, so she actually had access to these kind of articles, read the article, didn't take too kindly to it, and took Clifford Allen and the publishers of the magazine to court for libel. During the case, like with April Ashley, she had to be examined and provide evidence, and this was all happening at exactly the same time. And while in April Ashley's case the judge decided that April Ashley was not a woman for the purposes of marriage, during this case, as Georgina Somerset says in her autobiography, that it was during the tests of the court, Georgina didn't know her chromosome status, she discovered she had sex chromosome variation, and that she was mosaic XOXY. So the court case sort of breaks down at this point. Clifford Allen offers a full, frank apology in the court. Georgina Somerset says, that's all fine, donate all the fees to charity, and requests that the judge destroys all the notes of the court case, which he does, which is great for Georgina, not so great for a historian who wants all the details of what happened, but, you know, we move on. So to kind of go back to April Ashley, there's quite a lot of work on the Corbett versus Corbett case. but particularly around its continuing relevance for trans issues, trans law, trans jurisprudence. And if you want more on that, definitely recommend Alex Sharp's work. She's written quite a bit about it. And she quite rightly points out how the Corbett case is kind of haunted by homophobia. That this is supposedly about kind of legal sex, but it's all about homosexuality. And throughout the case, Arthur Corbett, her husband, his kind of sexual abnormality is stressed as a kind of, so he sort of admits to his own homosexual behaviours and things as a way of kind of casting doubt on her kind of legal sex. The judge describes April Ashley's vagina as an artificial cavity incapable of ordinary and complete intercourse. For Ormrud, Ashley's vagina is just kind of not natural enough. He describes it as this artificial cavity, like I say, and states this amazing statement that the difference between the Corbett sexual relationship and anal intercourse and intracrural intercourse is to be measured in centimetres. It's just too close to homosexuality. It's just troubling in that way. And John Randall, in the court case, described her as properly classified as a male homosexual transsexualist. Like a little gasp there. Yeah, that's good. So yeah, kind of horrible. And similarly, when Georgina Somerset's in court bringing this libel thing, it's about homosexuality. She talks in her autobiography about the fact that in this article it claimed that she was homosexual and her marriage wasn't legal, etc., etc. And it's obvious that the homosexuality is kind of a big issue here. Yeah, and it's against this kind of, like I say, the UK history backdrop at the time. And so even though in 1967 there was this partial decriminalisation of homosexuality, it didn't kind of lead to immediate change in public opinions, didn't lead to a drop in sort of police persecution of gay people. And even in 1975, this poll in the Gay Times found that while kind of most people were like, yeah, great, decriminalisation is a good thing, almost half of them thought that gay men in working in teaching and medicine should be kind of curbed. That's not some way you'd want gay people to be. So remembering that Georgina Somerset is a dentist and has a dentistry practice, that context kind of starts to make a little bit more sense as well. So I'm going to kind of try and bring this all together in this way about how this is relevant to today, because it's really important to see the kind of the workings of homophobia or heteronormativity working through these things. And in intersex studies, this has been something that scholars of intersex have been saying for decades. So kind of the classic Suzanne Kessler piece of 1990, where she talks about how early surgeries on infants to normalize their genitals is all about heterosexuality and an assumed heterosexual future for that infant, and it's all completely heteronormative. And so a successful vagina is one that can receive a normal sized penis, and they have to look normal and function normally, which is all within the norms of heterosexuality, of course. So this is really important, this kind of history of how we see intersex and trans and homosexuality is kind of entangling and butting up against each other and overlapping and being different and similar and tensions, particularly as there are current debates within intersex communities about whether to, say, add the I to the LGBTQ+ acronym, and people have very strong feelings either way. And I think this kind of entangled history is something we need to keep in mind when we're having these kind of discussions. And I would say still to this day, medicine and law don't really share a clear definition of sex in that way that back in 1955, Armstrong was saying medicine doesn't have a definition of sex. He was a medic saying that law doesn't have a definition of sex, but medicine and law don't have clear shared definitions of sex. The intersex activist and scholar Morgan Carpenter has described kind of very current contradictions that he sees, where medicine will construct intersex bodies as kind of either female or male, just needing a little bit of surgery and normalization to sort them out into those two categories, while law and society are kind of increasingly constructing intersex identities as neither female or male. And he talks about how kind of misconceptions about intersex being about third sexes or third markers on passports and things like that, rather than being issues of human rights and surgeries. What he has argued that that actually helps to sustain medical authority over disordered bodies by maintaining this boundary between medical jurisdiction over bodies and socio-political influences over classifications of identities. So we still have this kind of tension between medicine and law in how we think this through. So clinical decisions around intersex are very heteronormative, and there are legitimate tensions, overlaps, differences and similarities between intersex and trans politics, demands, needs, histories, experiences, stories, and I could say a lot more, but this is just kind of, I wanted to give you a little snapshot of one entangled history, I think, of intersex, that kind of touches on intersex and trans and homosexuality, which is also at the same time an entangled history of medical and legal classifications that have material effects on people in the past and people right now, and for kind of future people and for futures that we kind of striving to bring about. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.